Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this is a podcast that is hosted by me, Kyle Scunawill, and my longtime friend from work, Robbie Earle. Last week, I talked about how I had a little bit of a cold. It appears that through the microphone, through the camera, this cold transitioned all the way over to Robbie in Austin, Texas. So both of us are a little under the weather today. So if you hear some sniffles, we need some grace.
It's sure. The distance can't keep us apart, you know? It's
That's
beautiful,
it
really. It's also, you know that it's 2021 around here because we're talking about Spider-Man No Way Home and taking COVID tests.
Yeah, so I love that. Last week I talked about Warzone being shut down for COVID, and you twisted into a positive of like, you know, there really was some good stuff in that era. It brought people together. And then now I said that and you're like, yeah, it's really amazing how it just brought us so together. I love it so much. But yeah, back to 2021 today for sure. So one thing I wanted to share before we dove into Spider-Man No Way Home, which you and I rewatched last night. What a film. You and I have been talking a ton offline and I've been wrestling with the idea of ranking these films like we do.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, we talked last week about ranking the Marvels and Loki and kind of where it sits and whatnot. And it's such a strange process. And I want people to know that just because there's a part of us that feels like maybe we should just keep our rankings from the Infinity Saga and put that into a vault and then just start ranking new stuff. But that feels weird to like totally separate it out. And then there's a part of us that was like, hey, we should just do our individual preference rankings. But then on the website and stuff, it looks ridiculous to have under every film like 4 different numbers. And I don't think people have any idea what that even means. And then it's like, well, do we even need to rank anything at all? In some ways, we want to be different and not be the people that rank everything. But then it's like, I really enjoy it. Like I have lists of rankings of everything else, like favorite states and golf courses and all this stuff.
Right.
So I like doing it. And so then we've tried this joint ranking thing, but then that's kind of weird, right? Because what happens if we just straight up don't see something the same, you know? Like if you have Black Panther at 7 and I have it at 18, how do we accurately represent that on our website if someone is wanting to know how we feel? And then lastly, I do think the rankings are important as far as like I do like people who are genuinely curious to have a gauge before they go see the film of something. If someone's on a rewatch and they've never seen any of this, I guess it wouldn't be a rewatch then, would it? If someone's on a first time watch and they've never seen any of this, I do think there's a part of me that like, I like prepping like, okay, The Incredible Hulk, this is a little bit of a tougher watch.
Yeah.
You know,
and I
think there's a value to knowing that a little bit. Like if we can just get through this one, trust me, you know how that goes.
Yeah.
Like when I showed my dad, it's kind of like, hey, just trust me on this, like get through this one because there's some amazing films, but you need to know this, blah, blah. And so I think the ranking helps for that.
Yeah.
So that's a huge intro to say I'm constantly wrestling with it. Even though we ranked last week, I think I have a solution. Okay? Here we go. I think the best way to do this is to go back to our tiers. And essentially on the website, post 2 separate things. Like on the rewatch section, it would just say under the film, tier 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Uh-huh.
I think mostly you and I could agree on every film's tier, right? Like even if I'm 11 and you're 18, I think we mostly could be like, okay, that's a tier 2 film for the most part.
Yeah.
So I think that would be accurately representing. And I think that would give someone a prep of like, okay, Thor is a tier four film. We still love it, but it's not like the other one. So get through that. I think it would still accurately represent that even more than saying it's 33.
Right.
I don't even know if someone knows what that means when looking at that. And then that would free us up to just say the joint rankings is our tiers, but our individual preference rankings, maybe you can find those elsewhere on the website and it's a separate list, or maybe it's just on Letterboxd for you, or we share it on social media or whatever, and it's just for us to keep. But I think a preference list for both of us and then just tiers for our website might be where I'm headed with this. What are your thoughts on all that?
I think that's right. I like that. Because I do think that at some point it starts to get the hard thing about the MCU in general, whenever it comes to ranking things, is also the thing that we've praised it for so often, which is that it deals in a lot of different genres. So it gets really hard to figure out how to rank something with a ton of emotional weight against something that's just a ton of fun. Cause it's like, And so that's when it's like, okay, well, I guess you take it on its own terms, like from the sense of what it's doing, but maybe that the thing that it's doing just naturally isn't something that you're that into. So then that starts
to... Or is as important maybe culturally?
Yeah, yeah. So I think...
I know, like, even on IMDb's top 200, I'm not sure there's a single comedy, I don't think there is, in the top 20.
Right?
So like, how do you even grade a movie like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 when so much of it is funny, or Guardians 1,
yeah,
so much, or She-Hulk, let's say, which so much of it is a comedy.
Right.
Like a sitcom almost. How do you grade that if what it's trying to do is not even as impactful per critics, but it's doing it very well? I don't know.
Right.
This doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think even, this will, lightly transition us, I guess, or pre-transition us, but even thinking about No Way Home, as I'm thinking about that movie in the context of other Spider-Man movies, I have some of those same issues where even kind of like nostalgia aside for older movies, even putting aside like other MCU Spider-Man appearances, it's just hard because there are so many just differences. Like, No Way Home is a really unique movie. So how do you compare that to, say, Spider-Man 2 when they're just doing such different things? Like, the scope of them is so different. Like, the one has all the Spider-Men. Does that automatically make it the best Spider-Man movie because it has, like, all of them?
Right.
Or, like, is one that's more focused better because it's more focused? And I think that the answer is probably just, like... Yes, and I think that it's...
Well, and that's the part that I'm saying that goes even against what we stand for in this podcast, right? Like, we get up here and talk about critics seeing things different than audiences and all this stuff. And so even just the idea, like you said last week, of an objective critical view, what does that even mean anymore?
Right. It really is. Like, I think it's more and more the task of trying to look at something from the most cynical perspective. And
that's why I'm going back to the only value I see is, one, it's a little bit fun to rank these things, but then two,
yeah,
I do think, you know, giving somebody a heads up ahead of time can be beneficial.
And I think I've kind of come all the way around to being one, the tiers idea is a lot easier for me and feels like a less painful process, because I think that we do kind of know that as a gut thing. And you don't have to wrestle with the like weird nitty gritty of like, oh, but I really love this character, but I think that this movie is a little bit better. But I've also come around to, yeah, if we are doing preference rankings, at that point, it just gets fun again and is not... Like, it's honest. Like, it's an actual... Like, yeah. I'm really interested to hear what people's preference rankings are, way more so than I am to see them kind of... Like, obviously, everyone's going to have some like 5 or 10 MCU movies towards the top. And right. like that's, but I think that like you talking about having Iron Man 2 so high up or Age of Ultron so high up,
right,
which I would also have, like that to me is a way more fun discussion because I would rather hear what you like about that and what brings you back to it more than like, here's the thing, like the pacing in this is just extraordinarily done.
And you don't have to carry that baggage with you in these rankings, right? So right. like, even if you try not to, there's a little bit of you, like I don't love watching Wakanda Forever for whatever reason.
Right.
But I have to carry a little bit of baggage of being like, well, it is doing this well. And like, it probably is higher in my rankings than I really want it to be because I know it's a better film, but I don't care to watch it that many times.
Right.
That was a negative example, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The other reason this makes a ton of sense is there are two sections kind of in our rankings that have totally been fluid since we've started doing this. The first two films almost will probably never change for us with the two Avengers films, but 3 through 6 has changed 100 times.
Yeah.
Civil War, Guardians 1, Ragnarok, and No Way Home. We have swapped that order 100 times. And then the middle chunk, Multiverse of Madness, Shang-Chi, Black Widow, Love and Thunder. Like you and I cannot physically decide Wakanda right. Forever, like what is the order of those? And I don't even know that's important anymore. To me, they're all kind of a tier two film. And I think yeah. that's a better way to say it. Like they're all yeah. really good. You may have different preferences to different ones and I can't predict those for you, but they're a little bit flawed compared to the tier one films, which are basically not flawed.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I think at one point, and I forget what my top four on Letterboxd is at the moment. Candace is really good about using Letterboxd, and I'm not good about it. But I early on had Endgame on there as kind of my MCU representative, and then I realized like that is not super fun because, like, yes, I love that movie, and I think that it is at the top of my list for a reason, but I think that it says more to pick another, like I think I replaced it with Ragnarok for a while because I felt like it was just a better look at like what I prefer in Marvel movies and like the things that stick with me. And so the idea, my point being, we've always kind of had Endgame and Infinity War in the top slots, and that also gets kind of like I don't know what it would take to dethrone those unless like Secret Wars comes in. But even then, it's just like, I don't know if I want to have that conversation of like,
yeah,
you know, like,
even that's different though, because in Letterboxd, if you're trying to say what's my favorite Marvel movie in relation to all the other best movies of all time, like if I'm saying, you know, Inception, Shawshank Redemption, what one Marvel movie am I going to pick? That's even a different conversation, like you're saying, of how do I want to represent that?
Yeah.
But I think if you're going back through the MCU or taking somebody through the MCU for the first time, the reason Endgame and Infinity War are 1 and 2 is because you'll never find a film that will have the impact. Like I'm so certain right. you're going to have the impact with those two. And honestly, culturally, we may never have the impact again.
Right. Right.
And so that's why I kind of like in that list, in the MCU list, they probably won't be dethroned. And I think that's okay because that was such a moment.
Yeah. No, I, and that's the thing is I think that there's so many things that go into that it starts to get like, if the ranking is itself just going to be starting at like 3 pretty much every time, like there's a level of like, there's something anticlimactic about that too, where I think Good that point. If it's just basically any, it can go into any tier. And that's the other thing that I like about this is you can rank something, like you can put something in a tier without really having to judge it against other movies at all. Like
right, well,
you yeah. are like from like, you know, stepping way back, you are, because you're obviously saying it's better than something in the tiers below it. But I think
I also think it helps to have that. The conversation as long as you get in the same tier. Like I've always kind of felt like, you know, those like people that after a few years always come back on social media and go, you know, actually The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is the best Spider-Man film ever. You know, it always like gets better in time.
But y'all aren't ready for that yet.
Right. So I'm now seeing that with certain things in the MCU even. Like y'all aren't ready to talk about how good Thor 1 was. You know, you aren't ready.
Just I swear it's just it's like an AI.
But my point there is it's easy for me to have the conversation once we're just talking the same tiers. Like, for example, I think The Marvels is a tier 2 film.
Right.
But I don't need to argue if you think it's 12 or 20. And as the projects get greater and greater, even the fact of saying it's 17 to 20 sounds like that's not a very good movie because that's so many down. Yeah. But that's not what I'm saying. Just there are now 40 projects or 42 or something. So it's like,
yeah,
I'm saying it's better than average, but that number sounds really low, right? So even that, I think as long as you're kind of in the tier, you can have the discussion. It's like if someone's trying to argue that Thor 1 is a tier 1 film, that's where I go like, okay, I don't know that we're doing this in good faith. Like, are we watching the same project?
Right.
Like, are you looking for the same things I am or not? But if you want to argue that Guardians 3 is your favorite MCU film, I can't really argue that. I'd be like, that's okay. It is unbelievably well made. It's not my favorite tier 1 film, but you're in the same tier.
Yeah, and if you have the investment in that series that maybe other people have in the Avengers.
Right.
Yeah, I also like that we could look at different elements of a movie within tiers, not as like a formal grading system, but I think it would also be interesting to say like what tier villain is this, you know, like I think that's kind of a fun conversation to have that doesn't necessarily formally impact where we put the movie. But I think that like there are some movies that I would say are like tier 2 movies with tier 3 villains, you know, or tier 2 movies with tier 1 villains, like things where it's just like, I think that again, more broadly speaking, but that, yeah, you're right. Even just the numbers there's just so many Marvel movies now that they start to seem kind of meaningless unless you have a screen in front of you.
Yeah. That, well, again, I have to pull this out, but like just now the rough pass I did of this is that Guardians of the Galaxy 3 is the last film we would draw the line, I think, collectively as a tier 1 film.
Mm-hmm.
But then like Shang-Chi, Love and Thunder, Black Widow, Far From Home, those all being tier 2. Like those, I think, clearly have something that is holding them back from that top ones. I'm then kind of drawing a line at like First Avenger as a tier 2 film, and then tier 3 would then be like Iron Man 3, Ant-Man the Wasp, Guardians 2, and then tier 4 reserved for Captain Marvel, Iron Man 2, Dark World, Thor, Incredible Hulk. I feel like that's pretty fair. Like, to me, like, there's a difference between, like, Iron Man 2 and even, like, Eternals as far as how the movie is made, like, how well the movie is made. But then again, you can do whatever you want for preference, you know?
Yeah.
I think it also helps, clearly for me, with even the Disney Plus shows. Like, I can say season 2 of Loki and WandaVision are tier 1, but I would probably draw a slight line for season 1 of Loki and Moon Knight as like really, really, really amazing, but they're missing one thing that those first two aren't.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
No, I think that's fair.
We did the same. Did the same off-camera cough at the exact same time. Our throats are both just killing us. Okay. As a perfect transition to No Way Home, which we both rewatched. For a long time, I had No Way Home as my preference 3. But I always switch 3 through 6, like I said. Mm-hmm. On this watch, I think I'm going to totally swap it for me preference. So I'm going to go Infinity War, Endgame, Civil War. Mm-hmm. The longer I get it, like the further I get from that film, the more I appreciate all the different aspects of what it was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Then Guardians 1, then Ragnarok, then No Way Home to 6. You know, I was watching No Way Home last night. It is an unbelievable movie. But one thing that's different between that chunk of 4 films,
mm-hmm.
So I think like Infinity War and Endgame are almost like a 9.5 or 10 out of 10 the whole time, basically. Like Infinity War I'm watching is a 10 out of 10 the whole time. I never for a second think, oh my gosh, what are we doing here? Maybe even in Endgame, you know, we've talked about that kind of dips a little bit, but the highs are higher.
Right.
I feel like on this watch, Guardians 1, Ragnarok, Civil War are just a constant 9 out of 10. Like when I watch those movies, I have very little that pulls me out.
Yeah.
Maybe there's not like a singular moment in Civil War that's as high as some of the stuff in Infinity War or Endgame, like a singular moment, or even as No Way Home. But that's my premise. The first hour of No Way Home, I'm watching this going, this is like a 7 out of 10 for me. And there are actually things in this film that don't work as well, actually.
Yeah.
But then you get to the Aunt May death. And from the Aunt May death and really that apartment sequence on, there are times in that movie where I feel like an 11 out of 10.
Yeah.
Like there, like it brings some stuff out of me, the conversation between some of the Spider-Man, like some of that conversation brings more emotion out of me than any of those other three films that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So those other three are 9 out of 10 the whole time. This is like 7, 7, 7, 11, 11, 11. And that makes it really hard to grade. And that's why I think I went to the tier system. But that's what kind of struck me on this watch. Like there are parts of this movie actually that I don't find myself as fully invested as some of the other tier one films. But then it kind of like turns on a dime. And then is that a really genius call actually? And then I find myself really invested. And I can give you the specifics of what it is in a second, but respond to that first.
Yeah, I don't know that I disagree with that. As I was watching last night, I think that and this is kind of what I was alluding to earlier, talking about different Spider-Man movies. There are such high highs in this. And because I love Spider-Man as a character the way that I do, I think that I get something out of watching this movie that I don't get out of watching Guardians.
Yep.
And so again, that's kind of delving into preference things. But I think looking at it, what's hard is some of the things that make it such a kind of quintessential Spider-Man movie and some of the things that I'll talk about as huge pros, I still think also make it a little like, not clunky is the wrong word, but there are parts of it, it certainly does not feel as like perfectly put together as Guardians does, if that makes sense. Like Guardians is a movie that just from start to finish, everything feels like it's hitting at just the right time. Like it really is very finely tuned. And it's similar in that way to the like Infinity War, like what you're talking about, or even like in some ways I would say that like it's more similar to Homecoming if we're looking at Spider-Man.
I agree, I think.
But
sorry, he's dying over there.
But no, I think it's also hard because, and this is what I was feeling the first night when I got back from No Way Home and you and I were trying to record our initial reactions. There was something where I had really, really appreciated the approach that the MCU had taken starting with Homecoming. And obviously, Spider-Man kind of quickly became less grounded as soon as he started fighting Thanos, which I'm not taking any issue with. But I think that from that point on, And we've talked about this again, like as a Marvel Comics thing and an MCU thing, like you start having to kind of expand the context of the character. And I think that by the time we get to No Way Home, because we're doing the multiverse thing, because we're bringing in both villains from other universes and the other two Spider-Men, it just feels like it's taken a bit of a turn from how like focused and hyper like relatable the like John Hughes thing was in Homecoming. And so I think that like there is this element of like, oh man, like I don't know if this is exactly the ending that I would have wanted for this trilogy like coming out of Homecoming. But the thing that ultimately makes me so into it is I think it is the perfect like summation of all of these live action Spider-Man films and yeah, right. that it really makes them all feel like they count in a certain way. It does some great retroactive work. And the important thing is it also does like, and this is what I'm excited to talk about. It does do some things for the Spider-Man character that I don't think I knew I needed, like for Tom's character. And in that way, I think actually enhances it from maybe what I would have wanted or foreseen coming out of Homecoming. So it's
that's where I think it ultimately lands is like mm-hmm. the focus still ultimately does stay on Tom Holland though. That's why I think it's such yeah. a win is
yeah.
you can't explain the joy that I get from seeing all those Spider-Men together, but and it does enhance their stories. I totally agree. But I think ultimately you feel the focus on Tom by the yeah, end.
For sure.
So it doesn't take away in that way.
You've talked about this in the context of Far From Home before. And I think that one of the things that I feel in this is like that the jokes just
okay, hold on.
aren't they're not batting 1,000 in the same way that I yeah. think like Homecoming is. Yeah. And some of the Homecoming humor that's like really subtle and fits in so well with the kind of Marcus McFeely wit. But with like a nice twist that feels very exclusive to the Spider-Man franchise, that starts to feel a little bit not forced, but less discerning in that it's like you still yeah. get jokes that are that good, but you also get like for every joke that's that good, you get another one that's kind of like, like it's not bad. It's not like groany, but there are just moments in this movie that have never made me laugh. And some we've already talked about in the past, so I won't bring them up. But like some other ones that I noticed this time are like the Aunt May asking if he wants like fresh or salt water joke just never works for me. The laughing at Otto Octavius's name joke never works for me. Like things where it just feels a little like a little silly, little cheesy almost. But then there are
you're
other
things.
You're
stealing all of my thunder. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's normally the other way around, but I love it. Okay.
There are other jokes that do always make me laugh, though.
Let me just say then, the three reasons why on this watch, I'm like, this is a 7 out of 10 film, right? And then I'm going to explain why it's an 11 out of 10 film. But the first three reasons, I totally agree with the first two you just said. One, I do think it's not quite as tight as perfectly crafted, again, tier one film still, but as perfectly crafted as some of those references you were talking about. So mm-hmm. yes, I agree with that. It just feels a little bit clunky at times. The second thing, totally agree. Specifically, the first hour. It's literally like 57 minutes in when Aunt May dies. And yep, some of those jokes, they feel like kiddish.
Yeah.
They don't work.
It feels kind of Disney Channel.
It does, and almost even more than Homecoming
yeah.
in a weird way.
No, for sure.
And there are parts of like even like Doctor Strange's character that I'm like, I don't know why he's playing it that way as much. Like, why is he playing it so harsh on Peter?
Yeah.
At certain times, like even the call me sir, I it doesn't fully resonate with me like they're wanting it to.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's crazy. There's no way it's his girlfriend. That line, right? Like that doesn't totally work.
Right.
And it, in a weird way, I think the jokes kind of for the first hour defang some of these characters. So like Jamie Foxx is supposed to have this incredibly epic
yeah.
intro, and it is cool. It's one of the coolest visuals. But like I think back to when he fought Andrew Garfield in The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and how like intense that was when they're fighting. But then right
yeah.
away, we're kind of like making fun of all those characters. And it kind of is like, okay, how much of a threat is this if we're just easily, like even the way Dr. Strange is like, oh, whatever, here. And then just like
yeah.
dispatches of them, if that makes sense. It's
yeah.
a little like, it just feels kind of Disney Channel and how we're just like on a mission defanging these villains and just capturing them. And then the jokes that go along with it, don't all work. Now, some of them are really funny. Some of the jokes do hit.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I like, I
are we just gonna stand here and act like I'm not butt ass naked? Like that makes me laugh every time.
I also laugh. Like that makes me laugh. The like, was one of these guys made of mud? You got a cyborg with robot legs in my apartment? Like that.
One of the lines that makes me laugh so hard. Jamie Foxx is so good with his delivery when he goes, "Hey, listen, like, hold on." Peter's going on like his real intense explanation of what's going to happen scientifically when he puts the like charger on. And as he's in the middle of his conversation, he goes, "Hold on, one second. Let me ask you a question. Are those your Legos?" That gets me every time. Like, you're talking to me all about this crazy science stuff and everything you're going to do to me, but you're playing with Legos as well. Like, I'm talking to a kid. Like, that kind of delivery. There are some really funny moments.
I also like the moment where he's like,
"Those are Legos.
I can give you a real makeover or something." And
oh gosh,
Jamie Foxx is like, "Oh, let me guess, turn me into a lizard." Exactly.
Yes. That's hilarious, dude. Yes. Again, so there are some really funny moments.
But the best
line in the whole first half of the film is, "Damn, you gotta watch where you fall, I guess."
Oh yeah.
That is such a clever joke. And it's weird, I fell into a super collider.
And then the Toby line later, that'll do it.
Dude, oh my gosh. The "that'll do it" makes me laugh literally out loud to where I'm like,
"Ugh." And
he was such a nice guy. And then he fell in a vat of electric eels. That'll do it.
Candace watched with me last night. And there are a lot of lines that make her laugh out loud, which I appreciate. And that's one. But
that's
what's hard is it's not, but that
there
it's
are
not,
some, again, first half of the movie, there are some serious misses.
Yeah. I think that that's true.
Where like they're intentionally trying to be funny. It's not just like you can go, "Well, I don't find that as funny, but you know, it's a scene that happened." It's like, no, they're including that to be a joke. And it's a joke that just doesn't work. Like, I would have cut that joke in the writer's room.
Yeah. And I do think ultimately, they're able to elevate the threat of those characters with the way that the final scene plays out, particularly with Electro and Lizard. Like, you get some like legitimate, who are really comic relief at one point. You get some good kind of battle scenes. The same with Sandman. I struggle a little bit with the way that character is used here, just because it's not like his motivations aren't totally clear. Like, I appreciate that Electro and Lizard are in straight villain mode, and then Ock has like a good turn where we understand kind of where he stands, and then the Goblin is obviously
just crazy.
Yeah. And that's the character that I actually think is almost like across the board done perfectly, but we can talk about that.
Correct. Almost wish he was in it more, but yes. Yeah.
But the Sandman stuff, it also highlights another potential issue with this movie. And I'm kind of excited to get these out of the way, because like you said, I don't want people to hear this and then think that we're now trashing No Way Home. But I want to address these things, and then I want to get into all the things that I kind of discovered or rediscovered last night. But
this is perfect.
One thing that I do wrestle with here still is I've thought a lot about it. I think that there are ways to headcanon a lot of things, but there are parts of the, whether it's the way the spell works or the way that characters are introduced, it feels a little messy. Like it's not like, again, if you compare it and you hold that up to, especially like Guardians, but even Civil War or Infinity War, like, because we talked about Civil War, like how things get really convoluted. But I actually do think
start understanding every single character's motivations in that film.
Yeah.
There's no like, oh man, what is Scarlet doing here?
Like, yeah. Like if you step, and again, I think that you can get there, but I think the difference is with like Civil War, I feel like if there is a flaw that makes certain things like convoluted or makes like the Zemo's machinations like a little like roundabout. I think that it the flaw, if it's there, and I'm kind of increasingly convinced that it's not, is just that the movie doesn't maybe make certain things as explicit as it could. But I don't think the flaw is with the actual story. Like, I wouldn't say that there are any plot holes. Whereas No Way Home does have things that I think you could characterize as plot holes. And then I think it is now incumbent on us to make those not plot holes and no prize it, which I will do all day because I enjoy doing that. But it's like there are things that we've discussed, like if all these people are supposed to come over specifically because they know that Peter Parker is Spider-Man, then how come we have Electro? And then if we're talking about people coming over like right before they died, like why is Lizard back? And also why is he as the Lizard whenever Andrew talks about having already turned him back once and figured out the cure? Like, is that supposed to be some future version of him? And then like the Sandman thing, where it's just like, why is he only sand? That's never been part of his power, to where then it makes this like him being cured. But why does he even have to be cured? I feel like at the end of Spider-Man 3, he winds up like he doesn't have like a tragic ending. So it's not like Peter has.
Isn't
to
he
save
already him. Back with his daughter? Like, doesn't he like leave? If I remember, you know, in a cloud of
yeah,
dust
he like he like floats off.
Yeah, but to go find his daughter or whatever,
and,
right?
And he's obviously free to do so. He's still on good terms with Toby because he's eventually trying to team initially trying to team up with him in No Way Home. So they're just.
But
things
then,
that,
even there, yeah, he can still look like a human, right? So why does he walk around like sand in the apartment?
Yeah,
why is he unable to look like the person we are used to seeing?
And I don't know if that's some sort of like they didn't want to have to de-age Thomas Hayden Church.
Here's the point. I'm totally with you. There are actual plot holes. Yeah.
And
this is a perfect setup because a lot of times we take a movie that we rank low, right? And then we start by defending it to show you all the reasons why it's not as good. This is the opposite. This is a film that we both rank so high, like number three in our website right now. So we are now addressing and acknowledging some of the concerns of why it maybe might not be three. But this is perfect because we'll take a quick break and then we're going to come back and freak out about all the stuff that was just absolutely nailed, especially if you look past those plot holes. So I'm going to take the plot holes and throw that into kind of the same category of like one of my three things that's a little bit clunky. Like there are things that don't make total sense. There's things pacing wise. There are things jokes wise that just kind of don't work. And here's my last one, and you'll never bring this up, but this is kind of the epitome of a soundstage visual movie to me.
Yeah.
And I just don't like that. I don't prefer it at all. Like Spider-Man 2, one of the things Sam Raimi did is like they really lean into, and The Amazing Spider-Man, we want this to feel grounded in New York.
Yeah.
And this feels, for better or for worse, for some people they'd say, well, look, they can pull a bunch of stuff off this way. I never feel grounded in New York. It's so hard to explain. Even some of the lighting on like the bridge feels like we are doing this in a studio. Yes, you made an incredible recreation of the bridge, but we are not outside right now. Like when they're standing in the sanctum and it's all snowy, there's no effort to have like, or no, how about the very, very end at Aunt May's grave? It's snow on the ground and they're outside talking. There's no like ice cold breath coming out.
Yeah.
There's no like actual shivering. The lighting looks like studio lighting. Like they just put fake snow on the ground and then shot it in a studio. And I'm like 99% sure that's what they did. And I think you can get away with that in some films. In some ways, I think it's easier to do in a film like The Marvels because the whole thing is not on Earth. It's easier to like disassociate my brain with where we are. Here, I really don't like the visual direction of a ton of the film. Again, for the first half in particular. Like once they get to the Statue of Liberty, it feels a little bit better for sure. And like when they actually go to locations, like the school set feels great.
Yeah.
But like the roof, I'm not sure the roof is an actual roof. It feels like they just built that in a studio. It feels very similar to the shot of Iman Vellani and Miss Marvel going on her roof with her father, where it's like, this is clearly not a house in the suburbs. This is a house in a studio with studio lighting. And I just really don't prefer that. So clunky, some jokes don't work. And visually I'm like, man, this doesn't feel grounded in New York at all. Like this, the closest thing to it maybe is the swinging with MJ at the very, very beginning.
Right.
Or at least like a shot of Times Square kind of thing. Even that, I wonder how much was actually shot in New York.
Well, and
that's a huge flaw to me. Like, that's just something I don't feel, obviously, in like Russo Brothers films or in Daredevil, the show. Or like, I mean, Winter Soldier, you feel like you're in DC the whole time to me.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a good point. And I would say I had the same thought. And part of the reason I think about this is I remember texting Dan because I think he went to a screener the same night that you and I did.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing that he pointed out is that it is not like the locations are just not interesting for the most part. Like, I think that like the Statue of Liberty obviously is sort of a big one, but there's also something kind of like, I guess it makes sense because they need like the scaffolding and the platforms and stuff, but there's something that makes it feel less grounded because it's not the normal Statue of Liberty. Also, like it feels
also, it's
less
like we're gonna fight, let's take it to the Statue of Liberty. That's where we're going. Yeah, take the fight outside.
Which, like, I guess, you know, it makes sense because he's saying a landmark that everyone, even from different universes, would probably be aware of or something.
Sure.
But I do think, yeah, the exceptions for me are the school, like the school lab, the coffee shop where MJ works. I like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think the under Croft, like being like an under basement, that works.
And I like the. I mean, it's not really a set piece, but like the little bits that happen right outside the sanctum, I kind of like that feels like you're in New York. But the other thing that I would say, I think I'm okay with that because that has never really been what this trilogy has done anyway.
He's in DC, then he's in Europe. It's never synced with, but again, that's what,
That's why they
leave it at the end.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. It makes the ending hit so hard. Yeah.
Yes, the very last shot. That's the first time I'm like, oh gosh, this is Spider-Man in New York now. And maybe that's the point.
And that's, I think it kind of is because it's the first time, like if you think about it, even that final Far From Home swinging shot is so fun, but it doesn't feel at all like the kind of like final swinging montages that we would get in the Raimi or Webb films, where it's kind of got this like epic, almost like operatic thing. It feel like it's trying to feel like it's a teenager. And so it's still leaning into like those parts of it. And I think that what this movie, honestly, the reason why a lot of the flaws that we've talked about for me are forgivable, not the plot holes necessarily, but we can talk about that in a different context, but like some of the jokes, some of like the location stuff, I think it's okay because it's almost transitioning us, I think, and I hope, out of the coming of age, like Disney Channel adjacent element into like now Tom is going to be in a similar space as like the Toby Spider-Man, if not the Andrew one, where it's like now it's the costume, it's the, you know, all of the plot elements around people not knowing who he is, other things that I want to talk about later. But it's like, that makes me more okay with it because it's like, okay, maybe this was sort of the, like we really lean into the MJ Ned dynamic here as like them being friends and kind of like a gang. We like really lean into the high school of it all. Like, I think that that's great because now I think that they have to transition out of that because that's what the end of the movie fully sets up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get into that. I'll just say, like, I wonder what the thought is visually behind, like, that cemetery sequence. Like, what is preventing them from waiting until December and just flying Tom Holland, John Favreau, the director, and a small crew to any northern cemetery? Because there's no, like, skyline in the background. Doesn't have to be New York. And then just filming it there. Like, what's preventing them from doing that sequence? It's not tied in. They could have shot it later.
Yeah.
No one would know. Like, that's the kind of stuff where I go, I just wonder why. I wonder why.
Okay,
like the bridge sequence, that makes sense why you do it in a studio, as far as like controlling all the explosions, you know, having the stunt set up exactly the same so you can do it multiple times. Like, I get all that 100%. But like, there are just like the roof of them by their school. Why could they not have found a roof by a school? Like, would that be impossible to do during the summer?
Well, and in fairness, this movie, you know, we talked about like the 2021 COVID side of this. It would have been filming really in like the thick of the pandemic. So, I mean, it released in December 2021. Like, I think that.
Huh. I didn't think about that.
You know, so
I've never thought about that being a COVID project.
Maybe
they're finishing up towards that. You know, I would think like photography and most of the filming would be done, well, a year and a half before.
I mean,
maybe that's part of it. Maybe they couldn't physically get around very, I'll give them grace, because let's just see what Marvel does now from now on.
I mean,
here's my point. It feels kind of the opposite of Eternals, where I'm like,
yeah,
I so appreciate how every set, like when they go to a house in South Dakota, it actually feels like they went to a house in South Dakota to me. Even the interior lighting of that house.
Yeah. And it
feels like they just took the camera in my room.
I would be interested to do more. I haven't gotten through to this point in the MCU book that Joanna and Dave and Gavin wrote, but I would be curious to read the sections on some of these different Phase 4 projects to kind of see how much they were impacted. Because, Eternals came out a couple months before, so it's hard to say. Like, I don't know what the filming process looked like there. I do know that, like, for Spider-Man, you remember, like, in late 2019, because I know I was in France when we were talking about this, there was the news that basically Sony wasn't gonna like renew the deal with Marvel or whatever, and so they weren't going to do another Tom Holland Spider-Man. And so that means they definitely hadn't started shooting as of late 2019. Or probably
That's
even, they probably didn't even know what they were doing yet if they were still having those kinds of conversations. So I would think if they start in 2020, you know, COVID, everything really shut down, what, the first week of March?
March of 2020.
So I don't know. Yeah, I could see this being heavily impacted, I guess, but.
All right. You all know we love this film. So let's get into some of that stuff. But first, we want to tell you about a really cool thing we're doing with Organic Price Books for the holidays.
Speaking of the quintessential Spider-Man movie, the ultimate Spider-Man movie, you might say, we have a couple of Spider-Man collections available within our Friends from Work Recommends page on Organic Price Books. And one of them is the first volume of the Bendis Bagley Ultimate Spider-Man series, which is one of my all-time favorite comics ever. It's one of the first comics that I remember really just devouring. Like, I had the trades that I can't make myself get rid of now. They are just like beat to hell, because I used to just put them in my backpack and take them everywhere. The other night I was curious, once I saw that go live, to see, you know, if people were going to purchase that, what their experience would be like. And I started rereading it, and I stayed up way too late reading through the whole first arc because I couldn't put it down. So
yeah, you did.
It's a great comic. It's also really insane how much it serves as the foundation for every Spider-Man live action film and animated Into the Spider-Verse. Like, that series is drawing heavily from stuff that comes later in that series. So it is the most relevant book, I think, still to any Spider-Man film, but particularly like the first Raimi film, the first Garfield film, and all kinds of elements of the MCU stuff. So that is just one thing that we're recommending. If you go to our page on Organic Price Books, there's also a Spider-Man book by Chip Zdarsky collecting all of his work, which has been some of my favorite Spider-Man stuff over the last few years. He's one of my favorite comic writers. So if you are looking for any of that or something totally different, we're really excited that we kind of have this holiday package of just friends from work sanctioned comics. And we really think you should check it out.
OrganicPriceBooks.com, promo code friends from work. We'll be right back with everything that makes Spider-Man No Way Home truly special. Okay, just on a surface level, quickly, I've said this twice this episode, but I could watch Toby, Andrew, and Tom just dialogue for 5 hours. That's the thing about this movie that's so weird, is I didn't think I needed the other Spider-Man ahead of time. If you go back on this podcast and listen to our preview episodes, I was like, I don't know if I want them there. And who knows?
Right.
I am so full circle to where it's hard to describe the joy that it brings me just listening to them talk. Like, it feels like they captured a special feeling on set that they all actually share.
Yeah.
And everything I've seen in the behind the scenes of this only confirms that they genuinely have a relationship. They love each other. And I feel that on camera. It's funny. It's heartfelt. It's moving. It's powerful. The way the old Spider-Man are sharing knowledge with Tom when he needs it. Mm-hmm. And then it's cool. It's dope looking to see all three of them swinging. It's so just fun to soak in all the benefits of the MCU just listening to them talk. And so it's like, I'm probably overemphasizing some of the flaws in the first half and probably overemphasizing how strongly I feel. But from the moment it gets real in the apartment with Aunt May, I can't explain the amount of joy I get from watching them all interact. And then that's the second thing I'll just say really quickly. Aunt May's death, I think, and I'm going to do a Friends from Work Plus episode on this by myself. I started listing all of the deaths in the MCU. I think Aunt May's death is the second most impactful death in the MCU for me. Like, in how it's executed, first of all, absolute perfection to come from everything I just talked about, which is all the jokiness and some weird pacing and all that, to all of a sudden have it get so serious with Norman, and that scene with Norman when he goes, you know, changes the tone of his voice. Oh my gosh. And then when Tom Holland goes, run, Aunt May, to then how it's actually executed with her getting to say great power, great responsibility. You think she's actually alive, then she's actually dead. And then Tom's acting and how horrified he is of like, and then this is such a small detail, but to have Happy pull up and the music playing and it's the sounds fading out. And you just hear from like a distance, I have chills right now, Happy going, Peter, run. And it's so sad that they're now shooting at him because of this whole thing, but it makes sense. Like, the execution of it is only behind Tony Stark to me. I'm not kidding. It's that good. Yeah. And I'm going to do an episode on it because I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so from that point on, the movie becomes an 11 out of 10. One of the best films I've ever seen, with how Tom's having to deal with that, with how the Spider-Man are trying to console him through that, how that death is executed, some of the visual sequences on the Statue of Liberty, some of the dialogue in the Statue of Liberty, the way Tom has to say goodbye to his friends and how heartbreaking that is, and the cue, the new theme and the swelling, the music from that point on is night and day, game changer, and the healing with Doctor Strange, and then Tom not saying something to MJ at the end. Like, the end of this movie is so strong that I can't emphasize that enough. I love it so much.
Yeah, it does. Like, there are some similarities to Love and Thunder here in that.
So much.
I think that the first half, it's a version of Spider-Man that it exists as one of many superheroes, if that makes sense. Like, where he has, like, he wrestled some with this idea of his role post Iron Man and Far From Home. But I think that you're seeing these elements of him as like an adolescent. And that's what I was saying before, where I ultimately don't know if I view it as a flaw in the full context of the movie, but it takes me getting halfway through, because it's like 10 minutes before that, you have that Aunt May joke that I talked about never landing for me. But then in retrospect, it's like, that is kind of the shift that makes it so powerful, because you have this, like, Peter thinks
you almost need that shift, weirdly.
Well, yeah, it's like, oh, I'm gonna bring these guys in, I'm gonna figure it out, and it's very lighthearted and they're making jokes, and then it's like suddenly it gets very real and he's not prepared for that and hasn't really had to deal with that on his own before in that way. And so it's like, then it makes it so powerful for him to, at that point in time, meet Andrew and Toby, who have really had to deal with all of this alone. And that's kind of like what transitions him into what we talked about, that final scene really emphasizing so well.
Well, and just remember I talked about the defanging of all those villains, and then all of a sudden, in a quick instant, they're undefanged. Yeah. All of a sudden, they're serious and they're beating up Spider-Man to the point of death.
Like, even the scene where like the lizard comes out of nowhere and like slams him through the window. The goblin scene feels so straight out of early, even like Lee Romita comics, where it's just this kind of like the goblin's last stand, just mano y mano.
It's like so good. And the visual there too is so good. Like, and that's a set thing that feels good to me.
Yes, that apartment, like, building. The apartment itself always feels like, but I think that's part of it too, right? Like, he's in the apartment and it feels so quaint and silly, and like it fits within this Tom Holland Spider-Man universe with the Legos and everything. And then it immediately turns into this like nightmare where he's like falling through floors. And again, it just gets very real. And then Happy pulling up like he does, like you pointed out. There are so many little moments like that where, particularly when we're talking about it being too jokey or like clunky at certain points, I do wonder if that
chills
all
right now. Holy cow.
Helps to kind of like set up that
maybe
flip switch.
Because I would say from the moment that Peter Tingle is triggered, remember that? And it's a cool camera shot. It's like a GoPro attached to him or something on the front. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. It's his face and he's trying to find it and the sound's all weird. And then from the moment he does that, and then I have chills. Oh my gosh, I have full body chills right now picturing this. But when he webs up Norman's hand, and then I remember the first time watching it. Exactly. I remember the first time watching it going like, what's being triggered? Like, I don't get it. It's all going so well. Like, what is...
Yeah.
And then that quick turn, and then actually Jamie Foxx going, what the hell?
I was like,
Norman's on sabbatical, honey. And he goes, the hell? Like, what are you? That's so funny. But from that moment, I would say that's the thing. It's like, I was going to try to isolate one moment, but that whole sequence is some of my favorite cinema, I'm not kidding, of the last 5 years. And so like the payoff, and maybe they need the wonky stuff at the beginning to have that payoff. That's your point. Maybe. Because that payoff is so elite. Like Jameson narrating the failure while he's sitting in the rain, staring at the billboard or the video screen of him is so moving to me.
Yeah.
After what we just witnessed, and all in the context of Aunt May and Peter were just trying to help. Dude, that's what I'm okay.
Yeah.
I would say all the way through basically the end of the film, but especially through the time that then in that moment, that's when we meet Toby and Andrew. Like, what a perfect way to reveal this. Like, okay, zoom way out. On paper, there would have been so many different ways to bring Toby and Andrew in. Like, once we decided we want them in the movie, how do you know when to do it? For what reason? Like, how do you make it a Tom Holland-focused film if they're in it the whole time? There's all these hurdles to it, but they found the most perfect balance of, like, in that most heartbreaking moment, with all the setup with Ned magically doing it, all of this stuff in that moment, needing some relief to have them then come in, have some humor there, but then also the consoling. It's like, oh, gosh. It's a perfect handling of that death, and that movie just gets so elite from that point on. I got to stop. Sorry.
No. I think you're right. And there are a couple things out of that. Actually, I think most of my big picture things that I wanted to discuss really are either queued up in that scene or come from it. I think the first thing, the Aunt May death is not only really well executed, I think the whole idea of it is kind of fascinating, because I think at the time I looked at that as, oh, that's really creative. We're, instead of an Uncle Ben moment, we're getting an Aunt May moment. And I saw that as the kind of extent of the inversion there. But I think it's actually more than that. It's more inverted than that, in a way that I think really deepens both the Tom Holland character moving forward, and I think kind of retroactively informs the earlier parts of the movie and the earlier parts of the franchise. Because if you think about it, the point of Uncle Ben's death is obviously that Spider-Man could have done something, but instead he chose not to. And then now the death of his loved one results from that and becomes the constant reminder of the importance of using your power responsibly to help others.
Great point.
But that's not what happens here. Here, Pete, it's not that Peter could have done something and didn't, and therefore loses Aunt May. It's that he did do something, and because he was trying to help and use his powers, he loses Aunt May. And in that aftermath, where he's clearly questioning, like, oh my gosh, I've made a horrible mistake. I should have listened to Doctor Strange. I shouldn't have tried to do all this and handle it myself. That's when Aunt May then says, no, you did the right thing, because with great power comes great responsibility. And that's fascinating to me, because I think that we are meant to understand that, based on the Civil War conversation that we first have with this version of Peter, that he has had an Uncle Ben moment of sorts. We know that Uncle Ben exists here. We have, like, the suitcase. There are the lines in the Homecoming where he references it. And I think that the kind of summation he gives to Tony shows that he has had some kind of harrowing moment like that. So instead of just trying to kind of redo that, what we get with this Aunt May death is this look at the fact that it is going to cost you things. Like, doing this does not mean that, like, you'll be able to then save everybody. It actually means sometimes losing, like, to go back to the Raimi films, like, losing the thing that you want the most. And that, I think, is really beautiful in the way that it's executed, because then it ties in all the way to the very end with Peter choosing to kind of sacrifice his life, really, the life that he's known, every relationship he's ever had, knowing that that's the right thing to do. That's what he thinks his responsibility is. And he's going to wind up just in the same way that, like, that decision led to the loss of Aunt May. This will lead to the loss of everyone, in a sense. Like, it's a nuanced, really fresh take on Spider-Man that I think I undersold at the time, because I was just so caught up in how well executed it was and how emotional it was. But I think that that's part of what makes this feel like the the quintessential Spider-Man movie is because it sort of ends not just with him practically in that kind of solo spot, but also with him having kind of the weight of the world on his shoulders in the way that we've talked about the other Spider-Man adaptations highlighting and doing so well.
Well, I had not thought of that angle until right now. So you're further on this emotional journey than I was. That is a really good point. That is such a good point. I never thought about how all the other iterations, yes, it's that Peter could have prevented it. And here, if he had done nothing, it would have been prevented. And that Aunt May then still affirms that decision. And that is important. Huh? That it's important because he's going to give up right there.
Yeah.
And then the way they can bring in the other Spider-Man then to affirm that. Well, I want to talk about the last thing you said there, which is the other reason I can't get over this movie is that last 5 minutes. And that sounds crazy because it's the last 5 minutes of the movie. But when Peter is opening that janky apartment door.
Oh, yeah.
And you can hear bleed through the walls of other people talking, and it's clearly a rundown apartment. Rent is due on the first of the month. There's something uniquely special about this version of Peter because we've put in that time of his origin for three movies. For basically 9 hours, we've been with this Peter where he has tech, he has Tony Stark, he has Aunt May and Happy and his friends, and he's really got a community and he's got money. And when he opens that door, there's something that hits me as an MCU fan of like, oh my gosh. Like, I think this scene, to your point earlier, is more powerful now because of the legwork we did earlier than it ever would be in like the Amazing Spider-Man 1, because we don't have that background, right? In the Amazing Spider-Man 1, it's like, oh, we've seen this before with Tobey Maguire, right?
Right.
But here it's like, okay, we've seen this, but we've earned it for 9 hours to get here. And so that... Like, I'm also thinking about the video game and everything. When he opens that door and he's sewing his own suit, intentionally not using the teched out suit. And then he shows his phone and it's got the precincts from the different cop districts.
Yeah.
Like, it takes me back to the game there. Then he like looks out the window and it's so sad. It's so sad because he doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any of those things. No one knows who he is. He lost any family he has. Tony Stark, Aunt May, Uncle Ben. We've never heard about his parents. Like, he literally has nothing. And then he chooses to make his own suit, try to help out the police. And that one sequence, again, full body chills right now, of him just on the roof for a split second, swinging over people in New York, clearly, right? Now we finally have a grounded location. Right. Swinging over that, like protecting these people that are ice skating in a weird way. Like, just seeing that visual of like, oh, this is now what Spider-Man is called to be. And it's like we've said so many times, but it's right back to the Tobey Maguire entrance, right? It's the first movie. It's where he is now after all that time, but it's way more earned now. And I can't get over how elite that 5 minutes is at the end.
It's so earned. It also feels like a, like, I think the thing that I just respect so much about this movie is how much it feels like.
Your dog is going crazy in the background, by the way, for all these edits. Robbie's trying to figure out what his dog is doing. Samwise. It feels
the
like
crazy thing is, yeah. The crazy thing about this movie is how much it is able to channel both. You know, like, I think that that's what I respect is, if I were looking, again, if I were just looking for Homecoming to be resolved for that trilogy, this isn't really the movie that I would have picked. But I think that it, even aside from the work it's doing with the other franchises, just the fact that it's kind of like, this is really the only way that like doing the multiverse thing, doing the like larger than life stakes, like it's really the only way that they could have given us both. Like, we got the benefit of this very specific take on Spider-Man that is very rooted in the MCU. The MCU is very rooted in Tony Stark, especially the Infinity Saga, obviously. And so I think I like that we got to see that play out, what a Spider-Man would look like
with Tony Stark.
That actually does operate, which is, again, very different with from the other Avengers. Universes.
Yeah. Even the joke. is that helping us right now? That's one of my favorite lines, too.
That's awesome. What is that? But the fact that it then gives us, it sets up that, which I do think, like, you know, the fan community has been clamoring for the last few years, but I think also the Spider-Man character ultimately needs, like, I think this was that being played out. And I like now that, and this is another one of the big points here for me, I like that this movie gives Peter a reason to need a secret identity. Like, moving forward, like, I know we've talked about the MCU not being really big on secret identities because of the tone that Tony Stark sets. And so there's this level of, like, when you're watching Homecoming and Far From Home, it's like, why does he have to keep this secret in this way? Like, he's kind of the only person. It's not like Daredevil, where if he doesn't, then he's going to, like, jeopardize his
in
his
a world where Hulk is not career. Secret and Black Widow's not secret and Iron Man's not secret, and, like, so the average American or New York person would just be like, oh, it's another superhero. Oh well, like, but it wouldn't be a big deal,
right? But now what I love is that because he's kept it secret, and then it's revealed in the way Mysterio does, he's now, like, public enemy in a way that's very Spider-Man. But then beyond even the setup from Far From Home, what No Way Home does is it then takes it to a point of he sees what happens to the people that he loves when people know who he is.
Good point.
When his worlds collide.
Yep.
And that is the classic why Spider-Man has a secret identity thing. And so I love that it's like...
Well, and any character, really. Batman too, like any superhero, yeah.
But I that is what's really captured in that final conversation with him and MJ, obviously. It's this, like...
Yeah, good point.
He's now choosing not to do that because he knows that, like...
Where that road leads.
He's missing out on relationships, but he also can't do that without endangering
people. It's the sacrifice. Yes, he has to sacrifice.
It's just the stuff that, like, that's where... When we're talking about it being, you know, how expertly crafted certain things in like Guardians are versus here, there are things at a higher level that, like, when you kind of stand back and I guess try to see the forest instead of the trees, it's like, yeah, I don't know. A lot of it, I think, is necessary to some degree.
I totally even if it's agree. Like,
which is crazy. But it's like, that was one of my biggest thing probably from this movie was just how well it recognized the elements that you have for Spider-Man to be Spider-Man, some of which hadn't really been present yet, and gives us those in a way that doesn't negate the movies prior. Like, it lets those be its own thing. And it's again, almost like I'm becoming more and more convinced that you have to look at the MCU as the Infinity Saga and then the post-Infinity Saga, because I think that you can argue that for a lot of characters, there's an ending there that's natural at Endgame. And then I think that as they kind of move on from the MCU as defined by Iron Man, they start to kind of grow into different versions that can evolve more and change. But it's like, I think that does take some skill as a writer. So if we dogged them at all, I feel like this is where I get to.
It's funny how props. You and I go on different journeys with all these films, you know, and we ultimately, because we're on this podcast talking to each other, often end up in the same spot. These are some of the concerns you felt the first night I remember. But this is where we're different. I was so swept away in just the emotion of the ending of that film, like the how well they executed the last hour, that I almost kind of looked past all that first hour stuff we were talking about, or I was not going as deep into what makes Spider-Man Spider-Man here, et cetera. I'm not viewing it from that lens. And so I was just kind of like, oh my gosh, that was so fun to see all these people, blah, blah, blah. I often can be that way with movies that are fun. And so I'm more spur of the moment, but you were here. But then, you know, ultimately both go on our, kind of our journeys like this and crisscross to where you then saw what I was seeing kind of, and now I'm seeing what you were seeing. And then we ultimately talk ourselves, I think, to a similar point with this film, with a lot of films.
Yeah.
One of the other things I want to point out is, you know, we have so many different versions of Spider-Man in culture, and I've very much enjoyed this phase of these different projects leaning into that, like into the Spider-Verse, across the Spider-Verse, and just kind of poking fun of how many different iterations there are in a way. It's definitely meta, a little bit of a wink to the camera. But as a fan of all of it, like my umbrella has now gotten large enough that I can house all of these things and be super stoked on all of them. I love the intentionality at making all of these Spider-Men feel a little bit different. We talk about that in the game, how swinging with Miles and his personality even feels different than swinging with Peter. But here, I love each character really leaning into the quirks and the positive traits of that Spider-Man. And so instantly, just acknowledging that Toby is older and he's been around a long time, like that he even comes through the portal in youth group pastor clothes, right?
Right.
And not in a suit. Excuse me. But then how, you know, he's always counseling and he's wise and sharing his experience. And Andrew feels very much like the Andrew, you know, a little more emotional, but he's further down the line now. And so I understand Dan Gavazdin's reasoning towards why Spider-Man wouldn't spear Norman at the end with the Goblin ship. But that's one of the things I like about making Tom's version different. So that's another defining trait to me.
Yeah.
Is like, I like seeing Tom so early on his journey that he's letting the rage get the best of him. And Toby has been there. Like, that does happen to Toby in the first couple of Spider-Man films. And he knows what it's like to let the rage get the best of him. So the fact that Toby stops it, I think not only is a key plot point, but I like that they just make them all feel distinct that way.
Yeah. Well, and even the body language, like Andrew kind of has the exasperated thing going. I like that there's this shift with him where he starts being really, like he's compensating a lot and kind of being like overly defensive. And then at the end, he's the one that's being the most affectionate. Because it's like he's the one that's kind of needed that.
Yeah. No, I need this. Yeah. You know, that's, I need to hear that. Yeah. I need that.
Because he's like, because he is the one that's truly, truly isolated.
Yeah.
At this point. And, but I also,
I love
that's
you guys.
One thing.
Thank you.
That's one thing that I wanted to highlight earlier. That's a smaller thing, but, talking about it being kind of clunky, you know, I think that in some ways is increased, as it almost always is, if you watch the extended edition. But I really, recognizing that and recognizing that because of that, it may not be the film that I would show people for the first time, but I really enjoy almost every new thing we're given. There are a few things that just feel like an outtake that they just like threw in. But like in the same, like I really love the high school camera interview thing because I think those jokes are some of the funniest. They feel like homecoming kind of jokes to me. And it feels like it really lets us live in the consequences of a high school Peter whose identity is revealed. But the thing that I love even more than that is just the little expansions of the Toby Andrew Tom conversations, because I remember thinking even in the theater, like, oh, like I just want, it's like what you always say about the endgame battle. Like, I don't want like 10 more minutes, but I would like 2 more minutes, like just a little bit more of this. And I really like them having a fuller conversation about the webbing. I just think that's a really funny part in general. And I think some of the lines that didn't make it into the theatrical cut are actually some of the funnier ones.
See, I think Endgame could really use the 5 minutes to really cement the epicness of that battle. So that's a different kind of want. Here, I want more of it just because I could listen to it for 5 hours. the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
But I actually feel like the cut we got is perfect. Like, I don't leave watching last night going like, man, I really, as a viewer, need more, if that makes sense. Like, I could take more.
Yeah, no,
but
no.
But I'm okay with what they did. It's the right amount.
No, I don't,
to me.
Yeah. I think I'm happy with the way it was released. Like, I like that two versions exist. But I do.
But I see what you're saying.
I think that both are additive. And I wanted to point that out because I think that almost all of those jokes are really funny to me. And so for all of the jokes that I've kind of said don't land as much.
Good point.
The last thing that I wanted to note, and then if you have anything else, I'll let you
think that's it for me.
Land the fish. But
let's land this plane. You don't land
I just
fish.
I wanted to talk about just briefly how excellent of a villain Norman Osborn is here, and just how on like a Tom level, on just like the Spider-Man franchise level as a whole, whether we're looking at it from Toby's perspective or Tom's or all, like, it's just one of the things that superhero movies used to do, the MCU used to do and still does to some degree. It was always like the villain died at the end. And so anytime, you know, it's like you look back at like the Keaton Batman, right? Like the Joker is introduced in the same movie where the Joker is killed. Like that's how it always worked. And so there was always this element of like, oh man, like the Goblin's gone. It was a great first villain for Spider-Man. We kind of have it come back a little bit with Harry in a way that doesn't really work super well.
Right.
But it's like, not that I would have done that differently per se, but it's like, then there are all these things that you want to be able to do with the Goblin-Spider-Man relationship that are now just kind of foreclosed. And the way The Amazing Spider-Man 2 did it is not even really worth talking about, because that's easily the worst part of that movie. But I think for it to be the same version, because Defoe killed that so much in the first Spider-Man movie,
mm-hmm.
I think is great. I love that we like get the connectivity of the mask, that we see that suit for a bit, but then like I really love the character design of like replicating the kind of comic book thing with the hood looking like almost the Hobgoblin,
mm-hmm.
but just leaning into like Willem Dafoe's weird bone structure,
so weird.
As, like almost mask like. Like it's like because he's just perfectly like I remember people saying that was the one thing about the first movie is aside from just the costume there being kind of weird that you just didn't get to see Willem Dafoe's face acting whenever he's just clearly giving an insane performance. So I love that you get every bit of that here, like the way that he delivers the like Norman's on sabbatical honey line.
Hotel.
So it's like, it's all like, and it all fits, right? Like it all goes back, everything that he's going through with Tom, it's the natural extension of the conversations he was having with Toby's Peter about like you and me, like we're different, you know, like we should be able to take whatever we want. Like all of the stuff that's so at odds with the Spider-Man mantra. So it like, it fits so well. It's so natural. The fact that he's the one that comes in as the most kind of vulnerable and relatable and almost lovable whenever he's Norman and you feel sorry for him. But then I think like,
yeah, it's a very different Norman from the video game as an example.
Yeah. And very different from Norman as he's first introduced in the Spider-Man 1 film. But although speaking of the way he's introduced in the Spider-Man 1 movie, another reason why I think he functions so well as a villain here, I was rewatching the first Raimi film because it's a Thanksgiving film, obviously.
Obviously.
And one thing I had just never realized, and I'm surprised, but you know that the scene where Toby first meets Norman in the first Spider-Man, where he's walking into the lab where he gets bitten and Norman's dropping Harry off. And Peter says to Norman, I've read all of your work on nanotechnology.
Yeah.
Which I...
He did say that.
I love because it actually, like in that scene where Norman is helping him, I always kind of saw that as like, you know, Norman's so outclassed if you're kind of looking at the level of technology in the two universes. But then I realized like that it sort of elevates the genius of Norman to, he's not just like a businessman, which is kind of the role that he takes sometimes in certain adaptations. Mm-hmm.
Like the game more too. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he is actually closer to like a Tony Stark level in the kind of things that he was inventing like within his universe. And then it's like you go back and think about him having like whatever, like an 800% strength increase or something is what they say in the Raimi film. And then it's like things that you just never really got to see play out that were introduced as part of that character in the Raimi film. You get to see really explored here, like him just like really going to town on Spider-Man and like beating him to a pulp, which is not something that you've seen that many like Spider-Man villains do. Like normally,
Thanos.
It's
did.
Like it's one thing if it's like Thanos,
exactly.
But it's like
quick side note. You know that I love whenever people respect Tony Stark's technology. Like, you know, that's one thing I didn't like about Black Panther when they're like, oh, Tony Stark.
Oh, right.
I love that in this movie, Otto at the very beginning goes like, oh, nanotech, Peter, you've really outdone yourself. Like, he's like, oh, this is an improvement over even what I have. That's the kind of stuff I need. That's the hints I need of like, oh, wow, he is elite in this universe. And honestly, it's kind of like the reason I like that line even of I was in the Avengers and the other universes don't have those. I like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and even Elektra talking about like the
That's power. The other one. That was the other one. Him being like, oh, this is different. I want to stay here.
Yeah.
And then, and then Andrew Garfield saying, I've never seen him as powerful before. And then Tom going, it's the arc reactor. That's so cool to me. That other universes are like, oh, frick, what Tony did.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, it's so, and again, it's kind of it's a perfect trend. It's another reason why it's a perfect transition. Cause it's like the arc reactor again is kind of a part of this final moment of Tom's like,
oh, good point. Chills,
you know, saying goodbye to the part of his life that was informed by Tony Stark.
I have nothing to add on Norman. It's so good from every angle. I mean, no matter how you slice it, it's unbelievable. The only question I left with was, should I be watching more Norman? Like, is it a bummer he shows up so late at the end? That's it. But I think it's probably the right amount because we already have the history of Norman from the first movie, but that's the fan in me. Speaking of like, would it have been fun to have more of that? Because he was killing it. Even his voice, the way he talks when he switches to Green Goblin is so, I mean, it's maniacal. It's the closest thing we have to the Joker in the MCU.
I think that the only thing I would have wanted more of was him and Toby. But I think ultimately it was the right call because that would sort of split. Yeah.
See, I like him having the moment with Tom now. He's had his moment.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. Like, I think it has to be, and he's still kind of, you know, he stabs Toby. So it's like, and Toby is the one that creates the cure, which I think is important.
See, I don't need more Toby, but I need more Norman.
But the last thing I wanted to say on Norman and kind of like another one of those bigger picture things was it hit me that talking about him being the villain really of this movie.
Yeah.
And him being Tom's villain.
Mm-hmm.
I love that Tom's Peter here. He ultimately, like in kind of following Aunt May's guidance and in doing the right thing, he winds up sacrificing his life for Norman's. And what I mean by that is when Norman first shows up, there's this really kind of like, I think it's a moving scene between him and May and Peter where he's like, someone's living in my house. Oscorp doesn't exist here. And it's like, wow. Yeah. He is stranded in a universe that he doesn't have a place. Like no one knows who he is. He doesn't exist. Like how would you even function in a place like that? And May wants Peter to help him because of that. And I think that there's something really powerful about the fact that in doing so, Peter gives Norman his life back, but puts himself in the exact same position to where now he's the one that's stranded in a universe where he doesn't have a place.
This is a perfect ending because it takes us back to the very first thing we said. That's what makes this so complicated, is the ending of this film and some of the things it's doing are so special, That's why I don't think either of us have a hard time saying this is a tier one MCU film.
Right.
It's one of the better films of the last few years. It was successful on the critic front. It was successful on the audience front. It was successful in the box office, like massive, one of the biggest movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Endgame in that way, an absolute triumph in tying up plot lines from other films and all these years of character work that we didn't even think we needed. And somehow we got, and it was done so well that we need it. Like now it's hard to envision without it. And right. Just a true triumph. So I love it.
No, absolutely.
So this week on Thursday night, we will be rewatching the finale of Hawkeye, which I'm really excited to dive into because it syncs up so perfectly with the ending of this film, No Way Home, and syncs up obviously well with Christmas. So that'll be really fun. And all I'll say here is be on the lookout for a bunch of new stuff coming from Friends from Work, some new merchandise, some new planning stuff. And then we'll go into Christmas. And when we come back, we have What If, we have Echo, we have the Friendlies, a lot of stuff that we're just getting started on. So thank you for listening. Please, please rate, review, subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe to this podcast on YouTube now where you can watch these episodes and stay in touch with us on social media or our website, theffwpodcast.com. Otherwise, we just want to say thank you. However you made time for this podcast, we really appreciate it. And we'll see you right back here next time on Friends from Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.